Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
It's Monday, 18th of September, 2023. We are back in office after a trip to US where we had a number of events related to the Polish and Slovak elections and repercussions towards Ukraine, depending on how these elections may turn out. Our team was there throughout the whole week organizing our events and being hosted in a number of think tanks discussing policy issues with policy advisors or even policymakers. So we're going to talk about it, but maybe first we also touch on the pressing issues of this week and the recent days. According to our weekly outlook, we have a number of these issues, but the most important one and probably the one that will stay with us for longer is the issue of migration, issue of borders, borders of our countries and the European Union. Borders that are not just the borders in the east of the EU, but again, borders that are under pressure in the south. And we can talk about it more in just a moment. My name is Wojciech Przybylski and I'm here together with Adam Jasser in the studio. So Adam, maybe we start with the things that you think are the most important and why do you believe that the issue of migration will stay now for a longer period of time as a policy issue and a political debate in Central Eastern Europe and all of Europe.
Right. Thanks, Wojciech. Yes, it seems migration is back as a political issue, as a social issue. We've had this surprising scandal in Poland and now seemingly also in Hungary, where these two governments that apparently are so anti-migration and upholding Christian identity versus Muslim and all sorts of other sort of denominations coming from abroad and destroying European heritage. And apparently both governments have run visa for cash programs for citizens of countries from Asia and from North Africa. Apparently, Poland has let in hundreds of thousands of such workers into the Schengen area. And this partly explains why there was so much tension with Germany over the past few months about migration, because some of these migrants apparently have crossed into Germany, causing a backlash there. Contributing to the surge in popularity for the Alternative for Deutschland party and sort of intensifying calls among some German politicians for reintroducing border controls. And a similar thing happened on the border of Hungary, Slovakia and Austria. And there is a lot of confusion about what is really going on here, except that we see that for many citizens in Europe, not just in the East, but also in the West, migration is again becoming a huge challenge. And of course, last week saw also a stream of new arrivals from North Africa, from Tunisia, apparently, to Lampedusa, the Italian island, which is closest to the North African coast between sort of equal distance between the African coast and Malta. And it's very often a stepping stone for migrants from North Africa. And this happens just as the EU is negotiating with Tunisia some kind of a deal where Tunisia would in return for cash, would stop migration. So all in all, we have elections coming up in Poland and Slovakia. We have elections coming up, the European election. This is the end of the cycle. Last week, we had this really inspiring speech by Ursula von der Leyen about the future of Europe, about consolidating Europe, expanding Europe, sort of very optimistic and upbeat speech. And only a week later, she finds herself on Lampedusa trying to reassure Italians that, that the EU is with them and will be able to stop this migration wave. So, you know, I'm sorry for this lengthy introduction, but to me, it seems that the migration issue is going to be politicized. It is going to be used by populist anti-EU forces to spread fear, spread anti-EU messages. And of course, it's up to the EU establishment to wake up and come up with policies that are going to be accepted by the European voters.
Indeed, I think it's also begs an explanation. How did it happen that all of a sudden we have a big scandal in the Poland, in the Polish government, in the Polish MFA, Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs has been dismissed, Mr. Wawrzyk, after it was known that he has been involved in a scheme with companies outsourcing, that were outsourced to provide visas, working visa permits to Poland. And although Poland has issued hundreds of thousands of visa overall to country, to people or nationals of countries from all around the world, not just Belarus and Ukraine, who are in majority, the incoming workers and migrant workers, this hundreds of thousand estimate number is somewhere around 300,000 people over the past years of the rule of the Law and Justice Party. These 300,000 people were indeed coming from countries that Law and Justice considers a threat to the political and cultural identity of the country and the region. And then within this number, we have thousands of visas that were simply schemes, people pretending to have been Bollywood film makers, people coming from India, from other parts of the world. A recent report also mentioned people coming from Belarus who would buy their visa and they would be assisted from within the ministry, apparently for cash, for obtaining legal documents to travel not just within Europe, but also in the US. Let us remind ourselves the situation of similar proportion that was discovered as a scheme on the side of Hungary by the US authorities, and then Hungary did not cooperate with US authorities, led to suspension of or limitation, actually not a limitation, but limitation of a visa waiver program to just 1 year instead of 3 years of possible stay, possible travel in the US without prior identification. So US has already introduced as of 1st of August this year, this limitation because Hungarian authorities were clearly unable to answer the questions of why they were allowing people who were registered criminals or suspects of terrorist acts into the US. And that has been reflected on the condition of all travelers going from Hungary to US as of this summer. Now, Poland has not been issued such a warning. There is a clear difficulty on the side of US to make a move against Polish society that was so wholeheartedly welcoming and supportive of Ukraine in these difficult times of the war. But I would not exclude that very soon we will have very difficult questions also coming from the point of view of administration in the US that protects entries to US of illegals, from illegals, and especially those who are suspect to some schemes. While the Polish authorities pretend for now, also what else they could do during elections, they can duck and deny, that any of that has been of real impact and significance. But we know for sure that for a number of months, the Polish ministry knew about it, including the top of the ministry, including the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And apparently they were trying to wait and see, hopefully, you know, maybe waiting longer than they could possibly be, you know, have a realistic plan to duck these questions. And when there was a witness who's now under a witness protection system disclosing that information from within the ministry, they were quick to remove Mr. Wawrzyk, deputy foreign minister, who was also responsible for organizing elections abroad from the position, and to deny that this problem was of significant scale. Now, for all that we know, this problem is and has been of significant scale, and sadly, it will be also reflecting about our reputation, both in the EU, so within European Union, and NATO overall, that includes the United States, when this question of migration is becoming really serious. Ursula von der Leyen, in her speech, mentioned that Europe will extend hospitality to thousands and millions, in fact, of Ukrainians who left home since the invasion of Russia in 2022. But that is not a wholehearted invitation of anyone who wants to come. And I think by now, European Union is much more aware of what has been happening in terms of politics of the countries that were acting as smugglers, as basically human traffickers. And Belarus was one of these countries that has apparently tried this avenue and has been stopped. Well, any credibility that the Polish government has been building on this topic, which I think it deservedly has built some credibility of protecting EU borders and NATO borders, is now being seriously under question because the schemes underneath are just too bold to ignore, and they will bear repercussions.
Yes, there are two additional aspects. One, which is directly linked to this credibility issue. For some reason, and it was hard for us to explain, the Polish government refused any EU help with dealing with the border pressure from Belarus for some strange reason, apparently. Now it's a little clearer why this might have been the case. It's not just the typical Euroscepticism of the ruling Law and Justice Party. And, you know, another aspect which is of interest to me, and we're going to actually publish an article on this week, is the economic aspect of it all. You coined the term chaotic hypocrisy to describe how peace contradicts its policies all the time. Poland and Hungary and Viktor Orban, both these countries need workers from abroad because of the demography. And they have opened huge projects, huge investments into batteries and you know, some very important projects for the European economy. And they badly need workers from abroad. So, you know, while officially preaching this sort of anti-migration narrative, cultural identity, at the same time, quietly, they were bringing workers to man these new factories. So this is the hypocrisy.
Yeah, absolutely. And the migrant workers from Ukraine alone, even if you consider that many of the refugees were given worker status, working permit automatically in Poland, are just not enough. And the skilled labor for specific segments is badly needed. Now, of course, that reflects to a certain extent the situation in the US, where similarly there is a need for a skilled labor force. But the border control and the tensions over the especially the southern border of US have been fueling a lot of policies of Republicans, but also Democrats had to lean in. So there are clear resemblance, but most of the interlocutors we have had in the past week, when looking at Poland, they still see the image of a country that is welcoming, that is dealing with several millions of people who went through the country and over a million of people who stayed during the past year and a half since the invasion. And that image is now being shaken. The people are starting to pay more attention and asking questions. These questions towards Poland and Slovakia, those that we have heard, are of particular nature related to security, security related to the border, related also to the policies that may fundamentally change how we are perceived. First, in Slovakia case, the biggest question, and then certain, the lack of worry about Slovakia is that things will stay the same. But only a few of our interlocutors would admit and would actually say, and I think they're quite right, that a lot can be changed and a lot can happen in Slovak politics should be there a return of Mr. Fico to the position of prime minister in whichever configuration of the next government in Slovakia after the elections on the 30th of September. And the worst scenario should be indeed assumed, as we have written with Adam in a text a few weeks back, that Slovakia will be really a hard stopper to Ukraine's security in all dimensions, both in its ambitions towards NATO membership in the future, let alone this question, much more importantly, in transfers of weapons to Ukraine, especially that Ukraine would see Slovakia as unreliable in terms of information management vis-a-vis such weapon transfers. Of course, anything related to sanctions and sanction policy and the common position of the EU overall. And much more serious, of course, as NATO is much more serious topic, there is another topic of effort of the whole EU, the EU that financially, as we have learned from the recent statistic, has been now over the, in terms of support, financial support to Ukraine, have been providing more support than US financially. That is not to say that US has not provided critical and has been providing the critical military assistance. But at the same time, EU should be seen as the one providing Ukraine with the necessary means for upkeeping the whole society and the governance together, holding it up so it does not go into shambles. This ambition of support for Ukraine unconditionally on one hand, and with a stream of cash that would see in the future Ukraine rebuilt and joining EU, might be in question from a potential government in Poland, if this government is built on the nationalist vibes that are quite strong and present in Polish politics. Well, on security in NATO, Poland's standing ground in support for Ukraine, it clearly is in question whether a Polish government in the future will be such a supporter of Ukraine joining the EU, just as we have been hearing over the past weeks from many leaders of the EU. We simply don't have this question on the agenda of the political elections in Poland. And I'm afraid that if this question would pop up as electoral question, it would be clearly divisive and it would be maybe tilting in the answers towards the protecting an isolationist approach of Polish self-interest, not seeing the bigger win, which Ukraine in EU definitely will be. So this clear interest in the US, in the future of Europe and future of Slovak and Polish elections, at least in DC, has been known, is really something we have never seen to such a degree, in such extent. Yeah, and I think this also makes us pay attention to this week's State of Slovakia series of events where we're running in English for our subscribers, that you can join in, register and join in on our site, State of Slovakia, that's the name of the event, a series of four debates, Monday to Thursday, or later listen to at least to the parts that were recorded, so the first half of our Norwegian discussion, because Q&A is just for the people who participate, and we cordially invite everyone to tune in. So I think that's it.
Thank you, Wojciech.
Thank you, Adam. And now on to the interview.
Today, our special guest is Professor Marjorie Castle, a lecturer in political science at the University of Utah. Professor Castle specializes in studies of populism, but also democratic transition, especially Poland's and Central Europe's transition from communism to democracy. Professor Castle, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Just before our conversation, it just happens, we heard Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission President, the President of the European Commission, who is the main bureaucrat of Europe, if you will, deliver a rather political State of the Union address in which she basically laid out the case for further enlargement of the bloc to Ukraine, Western Balkans, and to consolidation of European power, if you will. So this is interesting because from a strategic geopolitical point of view, this seems like a necessity, but at the same time, we see some internal friction in the EU, the rise of populist, Eurosceptical political forces, and across the democratic world in general. And they may not necessarily share that vision of Europe enlarging, becoming strong, and so forth. And it seems that we're in a period of some democratic backsliding when it comes to standards in the US, in India, in Central and Eastern Europe. So what is happening to democracy, Professor?
What is happening to democracy? What a question. Democracy is facing a set of challenges today that are take a particular form that create special challenges for international cooperation, and especially the most institutionalized and complex form of international cooperation that exists in the world, which is the European Union. So one question that comes to my mind when I hear you talk about the question of EU expansion is whether this is good or bad for democracy. And I think the answer to that question is mixed.
Okay, can you elaborate?
I would be glad to elaborate. One thing to keep in mind here is that the current challenge to democracy is from populism. And populism is inherently anti-institutionalist. Populism as a ideological force hates any constraints on those who are supposed to embody the will of the people. Institutions are obstacles to the will of the people. These institutions can take the form of an independent judiciary, constitutional limitations. These obstacles can also take the form of international institutions, international commitments, in the form of treaties or in the form of membership in organizations, garden variety international organizations, or that most institutionalized international organization, the European Union. So what does this mean? So taking us back to what does this mean for, what does EU expansion mean for democracy? But populists fight elites. Populists need elites to fight. Populism is based on this idea of the opposition of the good, pure people and the evil, corrupt, self-serving elites. So for its political appeal, for its driving force, for its vitality, populism needs elites as an enemy. So the European Union provides those elites. There are always, of course, domestic elites to be the enemy. Anyone who opposes the populace is, by definition, just such an elite. But if the domestic elites have been defeated, or even if you just need to add a greater enemy, an enemy on the international level is particularly suitable, lends itself very well to the world schema of populists. So what membership in the European Union means is you have just such an international elite to oppose. You have constraints on the will of the, if populists have won control of the government, you have constraints on the will of the people. And as I say, populism opposes those constraints. Populism needs those constraints to fight against. So joining the European Union invigorates populism.
But how does that threaten, how does that relate to potential expansion as a risk for democracy?
Okay, because it will, it will tend to strengthen populism in the new member states. It provides them with something to fight against. It invigorates populism in those states.
Why is it? I mean, in Poland and in Central Europe, we saw huge enthusiasm about EU membership. And in fact, popular support for EU membership remains very high across the region. But at the same time, as you rightly point out, there is this populist moment in Central and Eastern Europe, in Poland, challenging the elites and challenging the EU as an institution. But at the same time, we have new potential members, such as Ukraine, which seem to be prepared to accept a lot of constraints, for example, on their sovereignty, in return for that membership.
Yeah, that is, of course, it makes sense for these countries, and the voters see that. And even at the time of accession, when it's all relatively abstract, the constraints, populist parties and populist movements may be perfectly in favor of Europe. Mm-hmm. But as when the constraints, and it won't be all the constraints, it won't be all the various limitations that the European Union ends up providing, but when the will of a populist government comes up against any European Union constraints, then it, as I say, invigorates populism.
But are you suggesting that with the expansion, the institutions in new member states are less resilient to provide the checks and balances, and therefore through enlargement, the critical mass of challenges, let's say, to the democratic order is going to increase, and therefore that is the risk for European democracy?
No, I wouldn't say that anything that stands up to populism is not, there is nothing weakened by joining the European Union. The domestic institutions are still as resilient as they ever were or weren't. It is rather that it invigorates the forces of populism themselves. And it is also important to realize that if we look at how the populist parties not in government have enjoy visibility through seats in the European Parliament, there's more than one advantage for populists in EU membership. In this, for example, it's striking to look at the decline of the British UKIP, the UK Independence Party, after Brexit. The populists are, the British populists were basically like the dog that was chasing the car and wouldn't know what to do with it if it caught the car. They caught the car.
Well, especially the car went off the road.
Yes, yes. And interesting, so the purely populist party in the UK is, it caught its car and it has little to no purpose anymore. It's trying to find a new one. But the populist strain in the British Conservative Party remains.
Yeah, 20 percentage points behind the Labour Party in latest opinion polls. Is this an inevitable end to populism, that, you know, politics without policies and in folly, and then folly leads to bad policies, and then it leads to a reality check?
That would be lovely. What you're suggesting there is if democracy endures, if that sequence that you describe depends upon free and fair elections with uncertain outcomes continuing, with a relatively even playing field. The levelness of the playing field is crucial here. As long as that continues, then yes, we should be seeing that kind of sequence you're talking about. The danger is if instead democracy is eroded beyond some certain degree that we don't yet really know how to define.
And the voters no longer are able to remove a bad government.
Correct.
So coming to Poland, you know, this is one of the big debates in Poland at the moment before the elections. And you've been here a few days now talking to NGOs, academics, and people who look at it here on the ground. What is your impression? Where is Poland moving? Is Poland already there where no level playing field is possible, or is it still within the norm?
Well, the question is, how level does the playing field have to be? There's the question of course, media access and media visibility. An ideal situation for a democratic election campaign is that the playing field is level in that regard. But this is, even without any role for state media, this isn't the question of media coverage of the various political parties is never a perfect picture. If you have a partisan press, if you simply have preferences among editorial boards, it may lean one way or another. There's always, even with a very nonpartisan media, there's always an advantage for the incumbent, because what the incumbent does is news.
Right. So how do you see it in Poland after your field trip?
Yes, well...
Oh, you specialize in Poland, you've monitored Poland's transition for so many years, so... What is your impression? What is your bottom line on Poland after coming?
Okay,
here?
Well, we know that the media playing field is not level. It is also true that Poland has had experience of having competitive elections under an uneven playing field in the past, which did, for example, in 1989, produce an unexpected, highly surprising outcome. So we know that the levelness of the media playing field is not the deciding factor. It can have, certainly has an influence.
Right. The difference between 89 and now is that back then, you know, there was a obvious to anybody economic collapse. And basically it was clear to everybody that... that the communist regime was basically on its last legs. Whereas now, if you look at the economic side and incomes, at unemployment, inflation, many other factors, it's still within the sort of normality. In fact, you could even argue that the last 8 years were quite successful. So that's...
Well, there are even greater differences. Beginning with, and it's an interesting contrast, it's an interesting comparison, one I hadn't thought of before. But if we explore it, the alternative, there was one very clear alternative in 1989. Currently, the opposition to the existing governing coalition is divided. And this, more than anything else in political competition, makes a huge and gigantic difference. There is also the fact that the major opposition choice has a track record. It doesn't enjoy a clean slate. It carries that baggage with it. It can't be viewed as this perfectly pure, clean alternative. So that's a major difference.
Right. In your conversation with the NGOs yesterday, you mentioned that one of the factors driving the populist wave across the world is our social media. And it's not a coincidence that we had the Brexit discussion and the referendum in the UK, the Donald Trump phenomenon in the US, and at the same time, the alt-right ideas sipping into Europe. Is this because of the social media and the fact that we have become such a global village?
Well, the question of social media and the global village idea is a very interesting one, because to a large extent, if you think about it, social media is still very much limited by country, with one important exception. It And that exception is intentional and covert interference by hostile foreign actors. But otherwise, social media, perhaps with the exception of, maybe a few really international celebrities, social media is really shaped
by the idea spread, you know, even if the debate is not international on some of these local issues. Some of the ideas that have come up, and in Poland, we've seen that, you know, for a certain period of time, we saw how quickly some of the alt-right ideas that appeared in the US discussions, they were almost literally transplanted into the Polish discussions. And Donald Trump, for example, has a huge fan club in Poland.
No, that's certainly true. I would be interested. If I followed, I wonder if researchers in social media are actually looking at the channels by which those are introduced. I would suspect there are specific groups. I mean, there are specific people who tend to follow the media of more than one country because of perhaps having lived in both countries and then really spread those ideas themselves, which is, you're correct, it is a social media kind of dynamic. It's a different dynamic from the way that the old media served to transfer ideas before the age of social media.
Idea travel faster these days.
Yes.
Okay, well, my final question is about another thing you mentioned in your discussion yesterday, and that was that, it really captured my attention because it was a novel way of saying something that we seem to have forgotten, which is that populism is often a power grab by a minority, sizable minority, but a minority that realizes it can no longer win the popular vote because of the changing demographic or changing social focus or whatever. But it's very often desperation. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Certainly. When I say a power grab by a minority, I mean or a power grab by an elite that realizes that its base, based on its previous appeal, that its electoral base is or has become a minority. And so I have a hunch, and judging by the countries that I look at most closely, those countries, I believe, support the hunch that it is this either prospect of loss and prospect of continuing losses or a history of loss that spurs political elites of, say, a particular party or a particular political direction or movement to reach for the trump card of populism. They realize that they're not going to be able to win in the future. They are frustrated by a decade or two of losses. And so they reach for this winning card. I have a hunch that this is what is happening.
The countries you refer to here are obviously the United States, but does it apply to Poland, your subject study as well?
Well, one is looking at future losses. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., it's looking at future losses as the Republican traditional support base declines. In Poland, it's because of the history of losses. I do believe that, you know, there's an understanding that the leaders of peace were frustrated by what they had managed to achieve or not managed to achieve in the past.
So they have become very good at using this winning card.
Exactly.
Professor, thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you for having me.